Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives, particularly one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It helps us to analyze and improve our own financial security, personally and nationally, and to deeply understand the cause of the problems we are personally experiencing financially. At the onset, I give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles on debt-related matters. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt. You should also visit her website by the same name. You could also go to www.kruufm.com under Archives to listen to all of the shows produced on this and other debt-related topics. This particular series is under Life and Debt Web. At the end of the last show, we looked at how the mortgage crisis was exacerbated by compounding the crisis with derivatives and mortgage-backed securities. In a June 2002 article titled "Fannie and Freddie Were Lenders," Richard Freeman warned that the housing bubble was the largest bubble in history, dwarfing anything that had gone before, and that it had been pumped up to its gargantuan size by Fannie Mae, the Federal National Mortgage Association, and Freddie Mac, the Federal Home Mortgage Corporation, twin volcanoes that were about to blow. Fannie and Freddie dramatically expanded the ways money could be created by mortgage lending, allowing the banks to issue many more loans than would otherwise have been possible, but it all added up to another Ponzi scheme, and it was reaching its mathematical limits. Focusing on the larger of these two institutional cousins, Fannie Mae, Freeman noted, that if it were a bank, it would be the third largest bank in the world, and that it made enormous amounts of money in the real estate market for its private owners. Contrary to popular belief, Fannie Mae was not actually a government agency. It did begin that way under the Roosevelt's New Deal, but it was later transformed into a totally private corporation. It issued stock that was bought by private investors, and eventually it was listed on the stock exchange. Like the Federal Reserve, it became federal only in its name. Before the late 1970s, there were two principal forms of mortgage lending. The lender could issue a mortgage loan and keep it, or the lender could sell the loan to Fannie Mae and use the cash to make a second loan, which could also be sold to Fannie Mae, allowing the bank to make a third loan, and so on. Freeman gave the example of mortgage lending financial institution that made five successive loans in this way for $150,000 each, all from an initial investment of $150,000. It sold the first four loans to Fannie Mae, which bought them with money made from the issuance of its own bonds. The lender kept the fifth loan. At the end of the process, the mortgage lending institution still had only one loan for $150,000 on its books, and Fannie Mae had loans totaling $600,000 on its books. In 1979 through 1981, however, the policy changes were made that would flood the housing market with even more new money. Fannie Mae gathered its purchased mortgages from different mortgage lending institutions and pooled them together, producing a type of lending vehicle called a mortgage-backed security, or an MBS. So, for example, Fannie might bundle 1,000 30-year fixed interest mortgages, each worth roughly $100,000, and pool them into a $100 million MBS. It would put a loan guarantee on the MBS, for which it would earn a fee, guaranteeing that in the event of default, it would pay the interest and principal due on the loans fully and in a timely fashion. The MBS would then be sold as securities in denominations of $1,000 or more to outside investors, including mutual funds, pension funds, and insurance companies. The investors would become the owners of the MBS and would have a claim on the underlying principal and interest stream of the mortgage. But if anything went wrong, Fannie Mae was still responsible. The MBS succeeded in extending the sources of funds that could be tapped into for mortgage lending far into U.S. and international financial markets. It also substantially increased Fannie Mae's risk. Then Fannie Mae devised a fourth way of extracting money from the markets. It took the securities and pooled them again, this time into an instrument called a Real Estate Mortgage Investment Conduit, or REMIC, also known as Restructured MBS, or Collateralized Mortgage Obligation. REMICs are very complex derivatives. Freeman wrote, "They are pure bets sold to institutional investors and individuals to draw money into the housing bubble." Roughly half of Fannie Mae's mortgage-backed securities had been transformed into these highly speculative REMIC derivative instruments. Freeman said, "Thus, what started out as a simple home mortgage had been transmogrified into something one would expect to find at a Las Vegas gambling casino. Yet the housing bubble now depends on precisely these instruments as sources of funds." And that's the end of the quote. Only the first of these devices was an asset, something on which Fannie Mae could collect a steady stream of principal and interest. The others represented very risky obligations. These investment vehicles fed the housing bubble and fed off it, but at some point, said Freeman, a wave of mortgage defaults was inevitable. And when that happened, the riskier mortgage-related obligations would amplify the crisis. They were particularly risky because they involved leveraging, making multiple investments with borrowed money. That meant that when the bet went wrong, many losses would have to be paid instead of one. And I'll return to this in a moment. If you're just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now back to Fannie Mae. In 2002, Fannie Mae's bonds made up over $700 billion of its outstanding debt, total of $764 billion. Only one source of income was available to pay the interest and principal on these bonds, the money Fannie collected on the mortgages it owned. If a substantial number of mortgages were to go into default, Fannie would not have the cash to pay its bondholders. Freeman observed that no company in America had ever defaulted on as much as $50 billion in bonds, and Fannie Mae had over $700 billion, at least 10 times more than any other corporation in America. A default on a bonded debt of that size, he said, could end the U.S. financial system virtually overnight. Like those banking institutions considered too big to fail, Fannie Mae had tentacles reaching into so much of the financial system that if it went, it could take the economy down with it. A wave of home mortgage defaults would not alone have been enough to bring down the whole housing market, said Freeman. But adding the possibility of default on Fannie's riskier obligations, totaling over $2 trillion, and this is in 2002, the chance of a system-wide default had been raised to radioactive levels. If a crisis in the housing mortgage market were to produce a wave of loan defaults, Fannie would not be able to meet the terms of the guarantees it put on $859 billion in mortgage-backed securities, and the pension funds and other investors buying the MBS would suffer tens of billions of dollars in losses. Fannie's derivative obligations, which totaled $533 billion in 2002, could also go into default. These hedges were supposed to protect investors from risks, but the hedges themselves were very risky ventures. Fannie Mae had taken extraordinary measures to roll over shaky mortgages in order to obscure the level of default threatening the system. But as households with declining real standards of living were increasingly unable to pay rising home prices and the demands of even larger mortgages and higher interest payments, mortgage defaults would rise. The leverage that had been built into the housing market could then unwind like a rubber band, rapidly deleveraging the entire market. In 2003, Freddie Mac was embroiled in a $5 billion accounting scandal in which it was caught cooking the books to make things look rosier than they were. In 2004, Fannie Mae was caught in a similar scandal. In 2006, Fannie agreed to pay $400 million for its misbehavior, $50 million to the U.S. government, and $350 million to defrauded shareholders, and to try to straighten out its books. But investigators said the accounting could be beyond repair, since some $16 billion had simply disappeared from the books. Meanwhile, after blowing the housing bubble to perilous heights with the 1% prime rate, the Fed proceeded to let the air back out with a succession of interest rate hikes. By 2006, the housing boom was losing steam. Nervous investors wondered who would be shouldering the risks when the mortgages bundled into MBS slid into default. As one blogger put it, quote, "So let me get this straight. Is the following scenario below actually playing out? For starters, Ma and Pa computer programmer buy a $500,000 house in Ballard using a negative amortization interest-only mortgage sold to them by a dodgy local fly-by-night lender. That lender immediately sells it off to some middleman for a period of time. The middlemen take their cut and then sell the loan upstream to Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, before it becomes totally toxic and reaches critical mass. At which point, FMFM bundle that loan into a mortgage-backed security and sell it to pension funds, foreign banks, etc. What happens when those loans go into their inevitable default? Who owns the property at that point and is left holding the bag? End of quote. Nobody on the blog seemed to know, but according to Freeman, Fannie Mae would be holding the bag since it had guaranteed payment of interest and principal in the event of default. When Fannie Mae couldn't pay, the pension funds and other institutions investing in the MBS would be left holding the bag, and it was these pension funds that managed the investments on which the retirements of American workers depended. When that happened, comfortable retirements could indeed be things of the past. In October of 2007, a U.S. District Court judge in Ohio threw another wrench into the works when he held that Deutsche Bank did not have standing to foreclose on 14 mortgage loans it held in trust for a pool of MBS holders. Judge Christopher Boyko said that a security backed by a mortgage is not the same thing as a mortgage. Securitized mortgage debt has become so complex that it's very hard to trace who actually owns the underlying properties in a typical mortgage pool. And without a signed note or assignment naming the parties, there is no one with legal standing to foreclose and therefore no actual security. That could be good news for distressed borrowers, but a major blow to MBS holders. Outstanding securitized mortgage debt was then up to $6.5 trillion. If large numbers of defaulting homeowners were to contest their foreclosures on the ground that the plaintiffs lacked standing to sue, $6.5 trillion in MBS could be in jeopardy. The MBS holders, in turn, might have a very large class action against the banks that designed these misbranded investment vehicles. The discovery that securities rated AAA might be infected with toxic subprime debt was making investors leery of investing and lenders leery of lending, and that included the money market funds relied on by banks to balance their books from day to day. The entire credit market was at risk of seizing up. It was at risk of seizing up for another, more perilous reason. And now we'll look at how the derivatives crisis has gridlocked the banking system. Once again, like in The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, in the middle of a cyclone, the air is generally still, but the great pressure of the wind on every side of the house raised it up higher and higher until it was on the very top of the cyclone, and there it remained and was carried miles and miles away. That's the eye of the cyclone. The looming derivatives crisis is another phenomenon often described with weather imagery. The gray clouds are getting darker, wrote financial consultant Colt Bagley in 2004. The winds only need to kick up and we'll have one heck of a financial cyclone in the making. A decade earlier, Christopher White told Congress, quote, "Taken as a whole, the financial derivatives market orchestrated by financiers, operates with the vortical properties of a powerful hurricane. It is so huge and packs such a large momentum that it sucks up the overwhelmingly majority of capital and cash that enters or already exists in the economy. It makes a mockery of the idea that a nation exercises sovereign control over its credit policy." Close quote. Let's have a station identification. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Martin Weiss, writing in a November 2006 investment newsletter, called the derivatives crisis a global Vesuvius that could erupt at almost any time, instantly throwing the world's financial markets into turmoil, bankrupting major banks, sinking big-name insurance companies, scrambling the investments of hedge funds, overturning the portfolios of millions of average investors. End quote. John Hoeffel's arresting image was a fleas on a dog. "The fleas have killed the dog," he said, "and thus they have killed themselves." Colt Bagley also sees in the derivatives crisis the seeds of the bank's own destruction. He wrote in 2004, quote, "Once upon a time, the American banking system extended loans to productive agriculture and industry. Now it is a vast betting machine, gaming on market distortions of interest rates, stocks, currencies, etc. J.P. Morgan Chase Bank dominates the U.S. derivatives market. J.P. Morgan Chase Bank alone has derivatives approaching four times the U.S. gross domestic product of $11.5 trillion. Next comes Bank of America and Citibank with a $14.9 trillion and $14.4 trillion in derivatives, respectively. The OCC, Office of the Comptroller of Currency, reports that the top seven American derivatives banks hold 96% of the U.S. banking system's notional derivatives holdings. If these banks suffer serious impairment of their derivatives holdings, kiss the banking system goodbye." End quote. Martin Weiss envisioned how this collapse might occur. Quote, "Portfolio managers at a major hedge fund bet too much on declining interest rates and they lose. They don't have enough capital to pay up on the bet, and the counterparties in the transaction, the winners of the bet, can collect. Result, many of these winners, also low on capital, can't pay up on their own bets and debts in a series of other derivatives transactions. Suddenly, in a chain reaction that no government or exchange authority can halt, dozens of major transactions slip into default, each setting off dozens of additional defaults. Major U.S. banks you've trusted with your hard-earned savings lose billions. Their shares plunge. Their uninsured CDs are jeopardized. Mortgage lenders dramatically tighten their lending standards. Mortgage money virtually disappears. The U.S. housing market already sinking, busts wide open." End quote. So let's look at derivatives. Derivatives 101. Gary Novak has a website that simplifies complex issues and explains that the banking system has become gridlocked because its pretended derivative assets are fake, and the fake assets have swallowed up the real assets. It all began with deregulation in the 1980s, when government regulation was considered an irrational scheme from which business had to be freed. But regulations are criminal codes, and eliminating them meant turning business over to thieves. The Enron and WorldCom defendants were able to argue in court that their procedures were legal because the laws making them illegal had been wiped off the books. Government regulation prevented the creation of funny money without real value. When the regulations were eliminated, funny money became the order of the day. It manifested in a variety of very complex vehicles lumped together under the label of derivatives, which were often made intentionally obscure and confusing. Physicists were hired to write equations for derivatives, which business administrators could not understand, Novak says. Derivatives are just bets, but they have been sold as if they were something of value until the sales have reached astronomical sums that are far beyond anything of real value in existence. Pension funds and trust funds have been bought into the Ponzi scheme, only to see their money disappear down the derivatives hole. Universities have been forced to charge huge tuitions, although they are financed with huge trust funds, because their money has been tied up in investments that are basically worthless. But the administrators are holding on to their bets, which are given a pretended value because heads roll when the truth comes to light. Nobody dares to sell and nobody can collect. The result is a shortage of available funds in global financial institutions. The very thing derivatives were designed to create, market liquidity, has been frozen to immobility in a gridlocked game. And that was all from Gary Novak. The author of a blog called World Vision Portal simplifies derivatives problems in another way. He writes, quote, Anyone who has been to Las Vegas or at a casino on a cruise ship can understand it perfectly. A bank gambles and bets on certain predetermined odds, like playing the casino dealer in a game of poker. Banks call this hedging their risks with derivative contracts. When they have to show their cards at the end of the play, they either win or lose their bet. Either the bank wins or the house wins. This is the end of the derivatives contract term. For us small-time players, we might lose $10 or $20, but the big-time banks are betting hundreds of millions on each card hand. The worst part is that they have a gambling addiction and can't stop betting money that isn't theirs to bet with. Winners always leave the gambling table with a big smile, and you can see the chips in their hands to know they won more than they had bet. But losers always walk away quietly and don't talk about how much they lost. If a bank makes a good profit, won their bet, they would be telling everyone that their derivative contracts have paid off and they're sitting pretty. In reality, the big-time gambling banks are not talking and won't tell anyone how much they gambled or how much they lost. We've been hoodwinked and the game is pretty much over. End quote. The irony is that derivative bets are sold as a form of insurance against something catastrophic going wrong. But if something catastrophic does go wrong, the counterparties, the parties on the other side of the bet, typically hedge funds, are liable to fold their cards and drop out of the game. The insured are left with losses both from the disaster itself and from the loss of the premium paid for the bet. To avoid that result, the Federal Reserve, along with other central banks, a fraternity of big private banks, and the U.S. Treasury itself have gotten into the habit of covertly bailing out losing counterparties. This was done when the giant hedge fund Long-Term Capital Management went bankrupt in 1998. It was also evidently done in 2005, but very quietly. Rumors of derivatives crisis dwarfing even the Long-Term Capital Management crisis surfaced in May of 2005 following the downgrading of the debts of General Motors and Ford Motor Corporation to junk bonds having a credit rating below investment grade. Severe problems had apparently occurred at several large hedge funds directly linked to these downgradings. In May 2005, Lothar Kampf wrote, quote, "The stocks of the same large banks that participated in the 1998 LTCM bailout, and which are known for their giant derivatives portfolios, including Citigroup, JP Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, and Deutsche Bank, were hit by panic selling on May 10th. Behind this panic was the knowledge that not only have these banks engaged in dangerous derivatives speculation on their own accounts, but ever desperate for cash to cover their own deteriorating positions, they also turned to the even more speculative hedge funds, placing money with existing funds or even setting up their own to engage in activities they didn't care to put on their own books. The combination of financial desperation, the Fed's liquidity binge, and the usury limiting effects of low interest rates triggered an explosion in the number of hedge funds in recent years as everyone chased higher and riskier returns. There can be no doubt that some of these banks, not only their hedge fund offspring, are in trouble right now." End quote. And we will continue this next show. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.